the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated.
Why won't you come forward?
Good morning. The first case set for oral argument this morning is Jerome Powers versus Dennis Powers and Prevailing Winds LLC. We have Sean Torno appearing and arguing on behalf of Jerome Powers. John Blackburn is present and arguing on behalf of Dennis Powers. And then Joe Erickson is present as local South Dakota counsel for Prevailing Winds. And then Patrick Malberg from Minneapolis is present and will be arguing for Prevailing Winds. I understand, Mr. Malberg and Mr. Blackburn, that you divided up your time. So Mr. Malberg will have 13 minutes and Mr. Blackburn will have 12 minutes or 2 minutes, excuse me. Okay. So each side will have 15 minutes to argue, and then Mr. Tornell, you'll have an additional 5 minute rebuttal. With that, you may proceed with your initial argument, Mr. Tornell.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm here on behalf of Jerome Powers today, who's in the audience, and I'm pleased to represent him. Unfortunately, while we're here, this is a case of a father, a son, a right of first refusal contract drafted by now Judge Anderson, and the interests of an intrusive wind farm easement and their interest in property in both Charles Mix and Bonham counties. As the court knows from reading the briefs, this right of first refusal contract case and the unfortunate dispute between the father and son, Jerome and Dennis Powers, results from the 2005 right of first refusal contract terms as drafted by then attorney Bruce Anderson. And I would submit, if you look at the Laska cases, we're going to talk about Laska 1, Laska 2, I note that those right of first refusal contract terms were also drafted back in 2005, I suspect, by the same entity. Your Honors, the difficulty with this case is that it seems as if all sides agree that these are unambiguous right of first refusal contract terms. We'll talk about it later, but really the circuit court and appellees want to argue at different stages as a catch-22 that, well, they're arguably ambiguous, but yet they're unambiguous. It can't be both. We would submit on behalf of Jerome Powers, my client, that with unambiguous right of first refusal contract terms, initially there are a number of errors to be reviewed. The first one of which, based on Judge Myron's decision that he authored in Nelson v. Garber just this last May, that it was improper and reversible error for the court to undertake parole evidence to get to the court's interpretation of the contract. And that is, as outlined in Nelson v. Garber, if the court is going to look at outside evidence or extrinsic evidence and circumstances, which it clearly did here, that is parole evidence and should not come into play in reviewing the four corners, as we all know, the four corners of a contract like we have with the right of first refusal. But by going outside of those four corners of the agreement, it was improper for the court to say, I can go outside, I see in the deposition that Jerome's intent was this because he said that, or it was this because he said that. That's improper. You don't need to do that, and that's reversible error.
Counsel, you know what? It appeared, though, when the court was actually explaining how it arrived at the interpretation it arrived at, it was confining the comments to the terms in the contract itself, and then referred, after defining or interpreting it, to the fact that some of Jerome's actions appeared to be consistent with the court's interpretation.
And I know that's the appellee's, thank you for the question, I know that's the appellee's sort of spin on this, but keep in mind, of course, that at the summary judgment stage, all reasonable inferences must be viewed in the favor of my client. And the court, in reviewing those external circumstances, whether it was to support the unambiguousness of the contract or not, was not viewing those external arguments or factors in my client's view, and it's improper at summary judgment.
But aren't you saying that we shouldn't even be considering those external factors? It doesn't matter how the court viewed those. We're looking at the contract. Isn't that your argument?
Absolutely.
So it doesn't matter if the court made some extraneous comments about, well, you know, this is consistent with the contract. Does that really matter?
It really doesn't. And where I can further address that and sort of bolster that point, when we look at and when we get to whether it's an improper restraint on alienation, that's where the court sort of showed its, and this is with all due respect, showed its true colors and said, well, given Jerome's interpretation, it's an improper restraint on alienation. But Chief Justice Jensen, you're exactly right. The court cannot look at those outside circumstances. And also I would point out, and I think we touched on it in our brief, but I want to make it part of the argument, that all of the lengthy deposition testimony that appellees pointed the court to, all of those items, I believe, or if not all, nearly all, were objected to at the deposition stage because it was improper. And that's the point we made, that it's the four corners of the contract.
Even without parole evidence, we have in front of us in the first instance a contract, an agreement, the text of which is uniquely situated for judicial interpretation by a trial court or by an appellate court without any difference or distinction in how they do it. And the fact that they might disagree about the interpretation in general wouldn't necessarily suggest ambiguity, but may suggest that the judge or the judges need to apply certain rules of statutory interpretation, make all the terms read together, try to divine the intent from the text, even if there's a disagreement. That may not signal a factual dispute. It may just signal a disagreement among the parties about the text. What are your thoughts?
Well, thank you for the question. And I would agree, Justice Salter, to the extent that you said all the terms, if we truly have an unambiguous contract, which is the first argument, that all the terms must be read together. And you can't, as you said in Edgar versus Mills and other cases, the court can't add or subtract language. What the court did here improperly is it did subtract language, and it didn't read all of the contract together. We know from first year of law school, any interest therein when dealing with a property right, of course, as you said in Laska 1, it not deals with not only sales but also leases and easements. The court made an interpretation, well, any interest therein, it must have meant sale. But what it didn't take into consideration, besides the phrase, any interest therein, and I know that's where appellees go, is, well, that's really the only phrase. It's not the only phrase, because in Sections 2, 4, and 5, it also deals with that the grantor shall not sell, transfer, or convey. And transfer or convey, if not explicitly, implicitly, is dealing with easements, especially when you're talking about any interest therein.
So if your interpretation, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if your reading of the agreement, which is at this point kind of styled as a right of first refusal, if your view of that is that an interest, divesting an interest in a leasehold or an easement or something like that would trigger the right to buy, Is that even a right of first refusal, or is that just an option? And does it matter?
I think it is a right of first refusal, as you said in last one, that right of first refusal is a conditional right that ripens into an enforceable option contract when the owner receives a third-party offer to purchase or lease the property subject to the right and manifests its intention. And so, again, given in Section 2 of the agreement that it's clear that any the transfer or conveyance of any interest therein triggers this part, which says that that can't be offered unless and until he shall give, that is, Dennis Powers shall give notice, written notice, to Jerome Powers. That never happened. That's clear within the record, and it needed to happen. And what is important is that summary judgment is particularly inappropriate here as to count two. Obviously, we submit it's inappropriate as to the entire thing. And by the way, keeping in mind that Laska, Edgar versus Mills, and cases of the like, Colonel Burner, I believe, were all trials that were had. They were not decided at the summary judgment stage, or if they were, it was deemed inappropriate. So, but specifically Laska, we know, was carried through to a trial, and at a minimum, that needs to happen here.
Is it still inappropriate, though, on the alternative issue and basis upon which the court ruled, if the court assumes the facts as presented by your client in all reasonable inferences and the facts as he suggested?
If you're talking about the restraint on alienation, in my
yes.
understanding, yeah, and it is inappropriate at the summary judgment stage, because what does the court do, and we can address that more, I know I'm getting limited on time, but because there in the court's opinion it says, well, if Jerome's intent was to stop, and I'm paraphrasing, it was to stop any leasehold interest or any interest therein, that's repugnant. And even though it has a specific duration of time, which is key under this court's findings. But they can't have it both ways. They can't say, well, it doesn't deal with leasehold interest because it's unambiguous, but yet to the extent that it may be ambiguous, then it's repugnant. You can't have it both ways. And there are factual issues in that regard. As to the why it's not an improper restraint on alienation is that, again, time and duration, as pointed out in Laska 2, are key to be considered. We know all the factors, and we would submit that the purpose is appropriate. It's not repugnant to an interest, because the purpose here was to keep the property in the family. I don't know of a case that says that's repugnant to keep the property in the family and to protect the property. Whether the price is fixed, we know from cases, and I believe I might be getting this wrong, but the Colonel Burner case, it's cited in our brief at the reply brief, pages 12 and 13, that price fixed, while they say, wow, that has to make it repugnant because it was $420 back in 2005, that doesn't necessarily make it repugnant. The party's intent, and again, that's where the court then did look to these extraneous and outside inferences outside of the contract to make that finding. We think that's improper. And then lastly, the duration of the restraint here was clearly limited, and that's what Laska, as I read it, with all due respect, it was sort of begging, there has to be a specific time limitation. And here it clearly is for the duration of Jerome's life. So,
but the circuit court, in looking at the terms, specifically stated it wasn't basing its determination of unreasonableness on the price term, but rather upon your client's interpretation that he was entitled to purchase the property with any type of transfer, conveyance, an easement, a mortgage to refinance the property, those sorts of things, which in the court's view was an unreasonable restraint on his ability to deal with the property
right,
as
right.
an owner as he would like. Go ahead.
Apologies. Thank you for the question. And again, we would submit that that's where the court improperly is considering this outside evidence and taking into the factors that should not be taken in.
What outside evidence are you referring to?
Oh, Jerome's.
This is your client's interpretation of the contract.
Right, because you don't need to get to my client's interpretation. That's why we objected to it. It's the four corners of the agreement. It doesn't matter what his interpretation is, and especially when the court had said his interpretation about it applying to leasehold interest is not applicable. It's only as to sales. What you don't see in the court's decision, and again, part of what is error, is that it says if that's if we're only dealing with sale provisions, then therefore it's repugnant and it's against the public interest. We don't see that here when you're dealing with a family property that was done for its purpose. I also want to point out that we want to make sure we get in our argument that certainly as to issue count two within the complaint, that it's inappropriate for summary judgment to have been granted to Dennis Powers on the specific breach of contract claim to which Prevailing Winds, or Prevailing Wind Park, I'm sorry, has no interest in the actual breach of contract. Obviously, they're dealing with, you know, whether their lease shall be good, but the breach is that Dennis Powers failed to give the written notices he's required to do. That's a breach. There was no, as required by Discover Bank, there were no statement of undisputed material facts in that regard. We would ask that it be reversed on those reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Garner. Who's going to argue first? Mr. Blackburn? Go ahead.
Good morning, Justices. I appear here on behalf of appellee Dennis Powers and in support, obviously, of experienced trial judge, experienced lawyer, Honorable David Kanoff's decision. I'm going to go right to the alleged failure to join in the statement of material facts. And I would point out to the court in our brief that the appellant cites Discovery Bank versus Stanley as the proposition for saying that the failure to give a statement of material facts is fatal. And in that case, Discovery Bank was the only litigant and did fail to use a statement of material facts. In this case, we have more than one litigant, and in our situation for Dennis Powers, we joined in the motion for summary judgment, and in that motion, attachment C1 to our brief, not only did Prevailing Winds make the motion for summary judgment, but also said this motion is supported by the accompanying statement of undisputed material facts memorandum and several affidavits. And our joinder in that motion said that we not only joined in the motion, but also in the memorandum and attachments. And as far as Prevailing Wind Park's motion is concerned, that motion was supported by the accompanying statement of undisputed facts, memorandum, affidavits, and so forth. I will also point out that
2 minutes is up, Mr. Blackburn. It's pretty quick, 2 minutes.
Story of my life, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The trial court did say that it took into consideration the motion, the statement of facts, to which there were no objections in the trial court. I think it was first raised on appeal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mahler, you have 13 minutes for your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court and counsel. My name is Patrick Malberg. I represent Appellee Prevailing Wind Park. I'm here to talk about three bases why the Circuit Court's decision granting summary judgment should be affirmed. First, that the agreements don't apply to the transactions at issue, the transfers of leases and easements to Prevailing Wind Park. They don't apply based upon a plain reading of the entirety of those agreements. Second, if the rights of first refusal agreements do apply, then they are necessarily void as unreasonable restraints on alienation. And third, an alternative holding as well, is that the statute of limitations bars Jerome's claims. On the first argument, as to why the agreements do not apply, I think the parties do agree that the agreements are unambiguous, and from there they depart very swiftly away from each other. But in order to read and determine whether the agreements are ambiguous in the first place, you go to the terms of the contract. Here we have Section 2, which appellant attempts to read in isolation without regard for what comes in Section 3 specifically. And if we look at Section 2 in isolation as requested, what it would require to do is for Dennis Powers to offer such property or any interest therein to Jerome. Such property makes some sense. The any interest therein, if it is meant or if it is read to mean something other than a fee interest, does not make sense when reading the agreement as a whole. And if we think about that, for example, if Dennis Powers wants to build a house upon the property, one of the things that Dennis Powers is probably going to need into that house is a water line. And let's say the water co-op says, we'll bring you in the water, but we need an easement for that. Under the interpretation advanced by appellant, Dennis would need to first offer to Jerome a waterline easement across Dennis's property to bring water into Dennis's house. That doesn't make sense. And we read agreements in order for them to make sense. And how does it make sense here? Well, we go to Section 3 of the agreement, the only portion of the agreement that talks about the terms of the transaction that would take place if the rights of first refusal are triggered.
Or, in your example, would you just have to offer to sell it to him?
Offer to sell. I think that's the argument that's being advanced, is that the offer, sorry, Justice Salter, the offer of any interest therein must match, right, the offer that Dennis is offering to a third party. So it would have to be that water interest.
So there has to be congruency between the offer that's in the offing and the right to whatever, purchase?
In Section 2, yes.
Okay.
Right? In Section 2, there is congruency. It's apple,
right.
It's apple and yep. Apple. But when we look then to Section 3, and it's the argument that's being advanced, is that we take a water line in order to provide water into Dennis's house on the property, and if Dennis wants to do that, he cannot do it unless he first goes to Jerome and gives Jerome a right under the agreement to say, Dennis, son, no, you can't have that water line. And as a matter of fact, now I'm purchasing the entirety of the property for $420 an acre. It's no longer an apples to apples. Right? And so that's under the first argument. If we're reading the agreement as a whole, which is what the circuit court did, the only way to make it make sense is to interpret the phrase any interest therein to be consistent with some part of the fee. Right, there are hundreds of acres at issue that the rights of first refusal agreements are triggered upon the sale of all of the property or some part of the property. That's what the circuit court did. It's the only reading of these agreements that can give effect to all of the language in the agreement. So that's the first reason why the circuit court should be affirmed. And if you do that, you don't need to get to the arguments about the unreasonable restraint on alienation or the statute of limitations. However, as an alternative holding, the circuit court did go to the analysis on restraints on alienation under 4335 in Alaska. Now, to be valid, a restraint on alienation must be two things. It must be both reasonable and for a legitimate purpose. Counsel this morning and in the briefing, it's talked about the purpose. If we're construing at this stage, the purpose of that agreement, the fair construction the fair reading is that the purpose was to keep the property in the family, to protect the property. That's where we'll allow that to go on the legitimacy of the purpose. But the circuit court didn't particularly dive too deep into the purpose of the agreement, and we submit this court need not either, because this restraint cannot be construed as reasonable. This restraint presents a uniquely oppressive, a remarkable level of control vested in the grantee beyond what we're able to find and present to you in case law. We do not have a case where we have been able to say here's appellate court review of a right of first refusal agreement that is construed, is read, so that an offer of an easement for something so small, so minuscule as to be a minor temporary encumbrance upon a portion of a property triggers a right so large in the grantee. We can't present that to you. I submit the reason we can't present that to you is because under the first argument, the reading that's being advanced is so strained that it helps us understand why this case should end at the four corners of the agreement. However, back to the scope and the reasonableness. We know from Alaska that a fixed price is not per se make a restraint unreasonable. We know that having a duration is important. Those two factors certainly don't weigh in favor of Jerome's position in this case. First, as to the set price, I would note that the circuit court got to its decision on reasonableness without reference to set price, specifically excluding that from his analysis, focusing instead only on the extent of the restraint. But here we know that it was less than the market value, about half of the market value at the time the contract was entered into back in 2005. We have Jerome Power's testimony that it is and was reasonably foreseeable at that time that the value of the property was going to increase. We have Jerome Power's testimony that at the time of his deposition in late summer of 2019, that property was probably worth about $2,300 an acre based upon a sale next door. And yet, in the agreement, we have no allowance whatsoever for any adjustment of the price to reflect the fact that the prices were going to go up. We don't even have in this contract any allowance on Dennis's part to actually recover in the event this agreement is triggered, to recover the cost of improvements that he would have put into the property. If Dennis improves this property with a pole barn and can do so without triggering the rights of first refusal, If later the rights are triggered, Dennis stands to lose not only the value of the land, but the cost of the improvements as well. So the set price in this case, I think, would weigh into the analysis. It would weigh heavily in favor of finding the restraint unreasonable. The duration of the restraint, if we go back to when these agreements were entered into, Dennis was a very young man. He was 22 or 23 years old. Dennis Powers was in his early 40s. We had a restraint that was going to last decades, 30, 40 years plus. And so this is not a duration of a reasonably short period. Yes, it is tied to the eventual demise of Jerome, but under the circumstances of this case and the time that would follow between the execution of the agreement and that event of demise, there's that factor weighs heavily in favor of a finding that the restraint is unreasonable. And we consider those things, again, then we go back to the scope. We consider the fact that the argument, the reading that is advanced of these rights of first refusal agreement allow Jerome Powers to say yes or no to the slightest of encumbrances for 30 or 40 or longer years to anything that Dennis wants to do to make productive use of the property, whether it be Dennis's own essentially non-farming use. Jerome's testimony is clear. Jerome, under his reading of the agreement, gets to say, yes, Dennis, you can farm. Anything other than that, you can't do it, and the property must remain fallow. That sort of restraint on alienation is a direct affront to the productive use of property. It's part of the reason that we have the rules. And so that duration, that set price, that scope presents, an appropriate case for deciding as a matter of law that this restraint is unreasonable.
But most of your argument really relates to your client made a bad deal. You know, he put in a price and it's too low and put on too long of a term. But, you know, this is a contract. There's no claim that there was duress or anything like that. He freely entered into the contract. So at what point should the court step in and say, well, this is a restraint on trade and your client made a bad deal and we're going to relieve him from it?
Yeah, thank you, Chief Justice. Small correction. I represent Prevailing Wind.
Well, excuse me.
With that, this analysis on when we're going to analyze whether a restraint on alienation is repugnant to the interest is required in these sorts of cases. Yes, people can make bad deals. I don't think a fair reading of this agreement is Dennis Powers making a bad deal. I think it's Dennis Powers agreeing that if he ever sells the property, he has to offer it to his dad on some terms. And it would survive. That agreement would survive a decision affirming this the summary judgment. Dennis and Jerome Powers may have that fight sometime in the future. But under the circumstances of this case, I think the restraint on alienation analysis is required, and there's only one outcome. We would ask that the circuit court's grant to summary judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Toronto, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Initially, as to Mr. Blackburn, on behalf of Dennis Powers, I would respectfully submit that he's incorrect, that my client did not oppose Prevailing Wind Park's statement of undisputed material facts. We, in fact, did so at Appendix D in our initial brief. And we also objected to the fact that Dennis Powers had not submitted, as the moving party, especially as to the breach of contract, that he had not submitted the required statement of undisputed material facts. As to Prevailing Wind Park's arguments, it's interesting, and I've appreciated Mr. Malberg in dealing with him in this case, but it's interesting when he gets to the point of saying, well, the court interpreted any interest therein by saying, and he stumbled, and I'm not picking on him, he stumbled because the court didn't address that. And they certain the court did not address that any interest therein dealing with the sale, transfer, or conveyance of any interest therein. And that's the flaw, and that's the impropriety of saying we're going to, if it's unambiguous, we're going to look at the four corners, but we're going to subtract out the language that doesn't seem to work for us. And where Prevailing Wind Park likes to point is Section 3 of the agreement. But, of course, Section 3 of the agreement simply says, should the grantor accept the offer of what would be my client, this is what would happen. What we're saying, of course, is he was never given that opportunity. That is, Jerome Powers was never given that opportunity because Dennis Powers failed to ever comply with the agreement. So,
counsel, what is your client's interpretation, or what is your interpretation based on the language of the contract with respect to what needed to be offered to Jerome by virtue of Dennis entering into this easement?
If an easement was going to be offered, I would agree to the extent that if an easement was to be offered, that an easement would be, that first of all, that notice would be provided, written notice, that there is an easement offered, and then the option would be, would Jerome Powers want to purchase the property?
Okay, now, but then the point I think your opposing counsel was making is if you just look at Section 2 and the reference to such property, if an interest or of the property or any interest therein, and let's just say it was conveyed, even though it says sell, to another party, then the offer would be made to your client to purchase such property or any interest therein.
Yes.
So then would that not refer to the easement, the any interest therein? And how does that make sense?
No, I think if you're going to, I'm sorry, let me interrupt. If you're going to look at the four corners of the contract, again, there has to be the written notice that they failed to ever provide. Then the option would be with Jerome. More than likely, and what they're getting at is, it would be declined. When you're talking about a minuscule portion, it would. We don't know that, and that's where a trial would come into play, but it would probably be declined. But he was never given that opportunity. Where their argument fails is they say it strains a reasonable interpretation to read Section 2 along with Section 3 along with Section 4, which says it's void if Dennis Powers doesn't provide that written notice. However, what they overlook, it's Exhibit E with our complaint, it's Settled Record pages 28 through 32, then why, if we're going to look at extraneous evidence and outside circumstances, the court didn't address this at all below, but addressed the other deposition testimony. Why do we not deal with the fact that Prevailing Wind Power sought to terminate that right of first refusal and sought to get a consent from Jerome Powers, which was denied? So, you know, they want to say, well, we're making sure that we have a clean title. If it strains credulity to determine that any interest in that property, such as an easement, would trigger the right of first refusal, then why did they seek, again, if we're going to look at evidence, surrounding circumstances, why did they seek to terminate that or get his consent, which was declined?
Mr. Torno, what was the ultimate remedy that your client sought in this lawsuit? What did you want if you prevailed?
Yeah, a declaratory judgment as to the terms of the right of first refusal. May I continue?
Yeah, go ahead. Finish.
Okay. As to the right of first refusal, the terms, and specifically that there was a breach of contract, which under Section 4 would void any of the interests, any interests that were given, whether it be easements or the like, that, again, my client was never given written notice of.
Thank you, Mr. Torno.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.